surprisingly, and then we can continue to debate that. We live in an epoch where our best theories are simplest at an extraordinarily large energy scale, the Planck scale. And that, I think, means that we're unlikely to have laboratory experiments that probe that scale anytime in the immediate future. That's just because the energy is way above what anybody could afford to build an accelerator for, if indeed the technology could be found. But in the beginning and in the expansion of the universe, we have an experiment that's already done for us, right? Those energies were reached, and there's 14 gigayears of data scattered over 42 light years, and we just have to analyze it. But like any experiment, the results that you get out and compare with what you see in the theory depends on how the experiment was set up. And in that, in cosmology, that is the wave function of the universe. And if the universe has a is a quantum mechanical system, then it has some quantum state, right? And which can be described by a wave function. And that's the objective of quantum cosmology, both to analyze that experiment and to complete the theory. So a view emerges that today's contemporary theories have two parts. They have a theory of the dynamics, summarized here by the action, and they have a theory of the quantum state. Both are needed to make any predictions at all. And one might think there is here an unfinished task of unification, that these should be separately specifiable. But I'll come back to that later. I'm going to talk about wave functions of the universe, restricting, first of all, to closed cosmologies, right, spatially closed cosmologies, and for simplicity, to a single scalar field coupled with a metric by Einstein gravity. So states in that picture are specified by wave functions on the configuration of three metric, which I'll denote by hij, right? And if we have one scalar field, by the value of the scalar field, and occasionally I'll leave the indices off for completion. I'm going to assume the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, following Dirac, right, that any physical wave function has to satisfy the constraints of the theory, implementing diffeomorphism invariance, and therefore the wave function has to satisfy the four constraints of general relativity, the most important of which is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Here it is, written down with no matter, and all this was explained to you by Claudio yesterday, right, in a slightly different notation, right, but it's the same equation. All we have a chance of doing in cosmology and quantum gravity at this point, right, is to work in the semi-classical approximation. Right? That's the thing that's most directly connected to what we see, and it's the most tractable of approximations. That is the leading order in Planck's constant. We can find what the leading order is for the wave function just by writing it as e to the I for some function, and then divided by h bar, and then write out the Wheeler-DeWitt equation to leading order in h bar. The leading order in h bar, it becomes the Hamilton-Jacobi equation for the dynamical theory. The solutions to the Hamilton-Jacobi equations are saddle points of the action, and therefore, in a semi-classical approximation, the wave function of the universe is going to be given by a sum of terms over different saddle points, e to the minus the action of the saddle point divided by h bar. Different wave functions have different coefficients and different sums. A particular class of saddle points that's important is what I would call the no-boundary saddle points. A no-boundary saddle point is something that's defined on a four-disc. The boundary of the four-disc has the metric and scalar field for which you're trying to find the argument of the wave function, it's an extrema of the action, generally complex, and the defining property of no boundary saddle points is that they're regular everywhere in the interior. But there's a collection of those. So I would like to define, in general, a no-boundary quantum state at the semi-classical level as sums over no-boundary saddle points, e to the minus I. Here it is written out, sums over e to the minus a no-boundary saddle point action, right, multiplied by some coefficients. The question is, what are the C's? So natural considerations of symmetries in principle restrict the C's. For example, in order that we not have something that singles out an arrow of time that is time neutral, we expect both the action and the complex conjugate of the action to contribute equally. That way, the wave function will be time neutral. Wait, pardon? You want to protest? Hey, I get to define my own wave function, right? You can only protest.
Can you justify that? Why would you ever like no arrow of time?
Well, we do have arrows of time, but the arrows of time are not built in at the level of the state. So, for example, Thomas and I calculate arrows of times in bouncing universes. We find they go in opposite directions on opposite side of the bounce, and that results from this
description.
Built in? The existing arrows of time can come out as emergent phenomena in the universe, which is, I think, plausibly what they are. But once again, I get to define my wave function. Okay, time neutrality, I'm assuming. The wave function should also be normalizable, and I'll come back to this later when I discuss quantum mechanics. Consistent with quantum mechanics, and Jonathan will describe much more about this tomorrow. Otherwise, we might want to try to weight all the saddle points equally. An important point here is that wave functions, these no-boundary wave functions, can be superposed just by combining the saddle points. If you have one defined by one set of no-boundary saddle points and another, you just combine the saddle points and you get the superposition.
Matter of terminology, if you call something a saddle point, that implies it's a saddle point of an integral.
I'm not using that terminology. I'm using a saddle point of the action.
I think if you replace the word saddle points with classical solutions, that...
You understand what this is, right? Yes. Let's not start objecting to the terminology. all right. Well, we want to do something with the wave function, which is make predictions. The thing we most want to make predictions about are what we observe, cosmological observations of the universe's classical history. Most of our observations about the universe are just about this, on cosmological scales, the approximate homogeneity and isotropy above, say, 100 megaparsecs, the vast age, the rate of the expansion, the amount of dark matter, dark energy, et cetera, and the evolution as described in several talks this morning for the fluctuations that make the CMB and then later galaxy stars, planets, biota, and us. That's the target. Now, quantum system behaves classically. Classical behavior is not a given in quantum mechanics. It's a matter of quantum probabilities. We say that a quantum system behaves classically when, as a consequence of its states in Hamiltonian, we predict high probabilities for histories with correlations in time that are governed by deterministic laws. That's as true for the flight of a tennis ball, as for the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, as for classical spacetime. So we have to calculate probabilities, first of all, to define whether they are classical spacetimes, and then what's the probability for different classical spacetimes that might occur in the universe. I'm going to describe one simple calculation that starts from the saddle point of view. It's done, and here, to do that, I'm going to use a mini superspace model where the geometry is homogeneous and isotropic, a single scalar field, which is also homogeneous. For the dynamics, I'll use GR plus a potential, which is, say, m squared phi squared, and a positive cosmological constant. Imposing these symmetries means that the state is a function of the scale factor, which inside wave functions is called B, and a value of the homogeneous scalar field, which inside wave functions is called chi. So in the no-boundary wave function in the semi-classical approximation would be given by up to factors e to the extremal action, or the saddle point action, defined by those values of B and chi, and that's a connection between the wave function and the semi-classical approximation.
So these, what is B and chi? A and phi? Or?
Yeah, there's some history here. Yes, A and phi. It turned out to be convenient for exposition to have a different notation.
And so B squared is A squared, or B is A squared?
B squared is A squared.
Okay, so B is A.
B is A, yes. A denote the history. B is the value argument of the wave function. Okay? So I didn't get confused putting B of T in here. Okay. This, as I mentioned before, the saddle point action is generally complex. And it just turns out that there are one parameter value family of these saddle points, with these boundary conditions, that can be specified by the value, the absolute value of the scalar field, right, at the south pole, the place of symmetry, which has been assumed in here. So we can try to now use this to predict emergent histories. Here's the wave function again. Taking account of the fact that the saddle points are generally complex, there'll be a real part of the action and the imaginary part of the action. And then we just use what amounts to WKB, an ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics. You know, if S varies rapidly compared to this factor, then you predict an ensemble of classical histories that are the integral curves of S. That is the solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi relations for connecting the momentum to the gradient of the action. And so you can compute, right, a one-parameter family of classical solutions labeled by phi and r. The probabilities, roughly speaking, are given by the square, or e to the minus 2ir, of b and chi. This is constant along those curves as a consequence of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation.
So, Jim, it's probability of having particular three geometry or probability of the history, because you wrote
it's a probability,
history.
In this case, of the history.
But history is determined by the set of B and chi.
Yeah.
And here you have...
It's this. If you like, it's a probability for these initial conditions.
History which leads to B on the board and chi on the board.
Yeah, that's right.
And beginning from what? From zero.
From wherever you calculate the integral curves from.
Yes.
Right. Now, it turns out, and Neil will like this, by itself, the no-boundary wave function predicts low probabilities for scalar field inflation in the beginning. Maybe that's even consistent with something you're doing. But those are what we call the third-person probabilities. For what occurs in the universe. The really interesting question is, what do we see? Right? But we ourselves, according to Everett, are quantum mechanical systems within the universe, and therefore we only have a probability to exist in any one Hubble volume. The probability is very small, but still in a very large universe, it's significant. Therefore, the probabilities for what our observations are, which are conditioned on the observational situation, at least what we exist, turn out to turn up here, right? They're, because they're proportional to the volume, so you multiply by e to the 3n, and then they go back up. So in the end, we wind up that we will observe a lot of inflation, even though the most probable without us is low inflation. So that's the story at the semi-classical level. I want to emphasize that this is a very successful program. Thomas, Stephen, and I have been working over the last decade to use this kind of framework to connect the no-boundary wave function so defined by these collection of saddle points, right, with observable properties of the universe. So does it predict classical Lorentzian space-time? Yes, I just illustrated that in a simple model. Does it predict early homogeneity and isotropy and inflation? Well, inflation in what's observed, and homogeneity and isotropy because it's an essentially Euclidean construction, which means the fluctuations start in their ground state. Does it predict arrows of time? Yes, because the fluctuations start out early and they get bigger, small early. Does it predict isolated systems, which are otherwise unavailable in the very early universe, like us? Yes, because it predicts gravitational collapse. Does it predict topology? Oh, if there's time, I'll come back to that. The number of large and small dimensions, we don't know. The number of time dimensions, there's some hints. Value of the cosmological constant, well, there's an anthropic argument, which we've given, which bounds it. Does it predict the complexity emerges from simplicity? Yes. So at the semi-classical level, the no-boundary proposal for the quantum state of our universe is alive, well, and predictive. Now the question is, can we do better with saying exactly what the coefficients of the saddle points are? Can we find principles for determining the saddle point weighting in the no-boundary wave function? And I would add, for addressing the problem of unification between the two pieces of the theory, which seem otherwise, the state and the action, which seem otherwise discrete. I should say, to say all this out, what formulation, which I was trying to get Neil to do, of quantum mechanics I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with the decoherent histories quantum mechanics, or consistent histories quantum mechanics, of closed systems. Might be said it started out by Everett, completed by these people, Griffiths, Amis, Gell-Mann, and so forth. That, as far as I'm aware, is the only formulation of quantum mechanics that's logically consistent, consistent with experiment as far as we know, and consistent with the rest of modern physics, like special relativity, right, field theory, right, and as is applicable to closed systems like the universe where all the observing systems are on the inside. I want to stress that it's not a new revolutionary theory. It's been around for the last 30 years, roughly the last time I was talking to Claudio, apparently, right? So we're as far from decoherent histories today as that is from Everett and that is from Heisenberg. So it's been tested, right? And by now it's appearing in the elementary textbooks, like those of Weinberg. Okay, a little on decoherent histories, and we're not going to be able to get very far with this, obviously.
So Weinberg wrote about Manilov's interpretation.
I would call this what Murray and I always said is this was an attempt at a clarification and a completion to a certain extent of Everett's formulation. But there's no doubt he started out the idea of take the wave function seriously for the whole closed system.
So you mean that he started this idea, or finally he came because he wanted
He didn't start. No. Everett did not.
Not Everett. Weinberg.
No, I was illustrating how the downhill slope of this theory, where now it appears even in elementary textbooks. Right. Not that there's anything wrong with it. Weinberg is an enthusiastic supporter, as far as I can tell, judged by his book and also by talking to him. The most general objective of any quantum theory is the prediction of probabilities for histories of things in time, right? And in cosmology, you know, if we would like that the Earth is not, does not necessarily go around the sun in a classical orbit, it could go around in any orbit. It's just that the probability for that is much lower than the classical orbit. In cosmology, these histories are Lorentzian histories of the universe, cosmological histories of space-time geometry and field. And I've already illustrated how to calculate that one. Generalized to gravity, and there is a whole framework of decoherent histories amplified a lot by Jonathan, right, on, and which consists of three ingredients. The fine-grained histories, or as I have already mentioned, are Lorentzian histories of geometry and field. You need to have some notion of coarse graining, that is, partitions of the fine-grained histories into diffeomorphism and variant classes C alpha, and a measure of interference D between the coarse-grained histories that defines when they decohere and what their probabilities are according to this formula. Right? So this is the so-called decoherence functional. It should be diagonal, and the diagonal is the that's decoherence. All that is only relevant for this discussion. For one point, the construction involves an inner product of the kind we were talking about, and so the saddle points have to be regular enough that it's normalizing well behind, and tomorrow Jonathan will explain a lot more about that. So that's an additional criteria for what the coefficients are. But the question is, can we get beyond this semi-classical approximation, as attractive as it is, as successful as it is? And one way to do that is integrals. Now, as far as I'm aware, there is no principle of any kind in that a quantum state has to have an integral representation, right? Most quantum states don't, like the second excited state of the hydrogen atom. But writing a wave function as an integral representation, if it's possible, has a lot of advantages, right? First, you get to choose the contour and evaluate it by steepest descent or Picard Lefschetz. It gives us a prescription for which saddle points contribute. Therefore, it's an interesting, and it has one defect, that the superposition of saddle points is not, that are both integrals, is not necessarily another integral. And it takes us in the direction of unifying the two parts of the basic theory, the action and the wave function. That is, it addresses this unfinished task of unification, because the state, yeah, I'm pointing at my screen, which is not a good idea. The action of the dynamical theory through this and a choice of contour determines the state. So it's more unified than it was otherwise. But there are other ways of doing it, right? In particular, building on work mainly due to Thomas, we can rewrite the no-boundary wave function in terms of the partition function of a dual field theory. The three metric here, so the notation here and there, right, is written as with a conformal factor factored out. This is the field theory partition function, certain theory with sources, epsilon, which is the ultraviolet cutoff, and H alpha, and alpha is read off from the wave function. The source is H alpha. This gives a, also gives us a prescription for which saddle points contribute and what is their weight are, and it's also a step towards unification. How much time do I have left?
10 minutes.
What? 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Oh, good. That's the end of my talk, except except I didn't know how I was going to do on time, so I prepared two comments, 5 minutes for each. The first is a plug for lattice gravity, which Bianca Dieterich explained yesterday, right? Although in some low number of dimensions, here's a you can build geometries out of flat simplices, as in the Buckminster Dome, where you get a curved surface built out of triangles. So here's a like, two-dimensional representation of that. Here's a surface which is built out of triangles. These triangles are flat, right? All the information about the geometry is contained in the square edge lengths of the triangle. You can actually have Euclidean geometries if the edge lengths satisfy the right constraints, or Lorentzian geometry where the squared edge lengths are negative. The curvature in two dimensions is concentrated, as you can sort of see here, right along the vertices, and in on the triangle, it's in the four dimensions, it's on the triangles. So we got a nice big superspace of dimension of the number of edges s with no symmetry assumed. So path integrals over geometries become multiple integrals over the edge lengths. And then you can have a lot of fun with contours, because if you have 100 edges, you have 100 complex variable space to discuss this. I can see many PhD theses arising from this. Any rate, but it's a more general way, without assuming symmetries, right, to discuss the sum over. I've written over here, so here's the wave function. It's a function of the boundary edge lengths, right? And so it's an integral over the action. The Reggie action is the sum of the areas, this is now in four dimensions, the area of the two simplices times the so-called deficit angle between them. And then there's a surface term. I put Raphael's name down here because we figured out the surface term together
40 years ago.
40 years ago, right? Curvature is concentrated. Where are we here? Well, that was the action. But most, I think, importantly, is it gives us a chance to do something else, right? All the existing proposals assume a particular topology. But in mathematics, a geometry is a manifold with a metric. So you think just as likely to sum over metrics should also sum over manifolds. That's a tough business, but you can represent manifolds with just different topology simplicially, quite easily. And just to show you, this is some old work. Here's the action. I haven't done any sums here for different topologies. Here's the action and a slice through with a certain triangulation and a two-dimensional slice through that. And you can see the action has a saddle point here, minus 4.85, whatever the dimensions are. Here's the same thing for a triangulation of CP2, another saddle point. So in principle, you could think about adding these up. You can have a simplicial wave function, which is the analog of this. This is the boundary of the manifold. And this is something like a in two dimensions, what would be an ordinary tetrahedron. And I just show that you have contours of integration. This is the steepest descent contour for doing the integral, right? I'm not sure whether it's Picard Lefschetz. I didn't know about anything about that in those days. This is the saddle point, this dot here. And this is the wave function that comes out. So you get perfectly reasonable wave functions. That's the first comment. The second comment, I want to say something about linearized gravity, because it is the venue in which the entire program can be carried out explicitly. And that is because in the linearized case, I'm linearizing away from flat, the constraints can be solved, suitable gauges imposed, and it leaves two physical degrees of freedom, the transverse traceless component, the two transverse traceless components of the perturbed metric. Now, that means we just have two transverse traceless fields running around on flat space. We know how to calculate the ground state, right? It's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators, and the ground state is a product of those harmonic oscillators. And it can be expressed in a Euclidean functional integral. So here's what the action looks like. It's just the usual quadratic action. Dot means time derivative. This is a spatial gradient. Okay, down here like this, L squared is the Planck length. And the wave function can be expressed as an integral over one surface, which has the arguments of the wave function, and then exponentially decaying to the past of that surface. And you get the right wave function that way. But as far as I can tell, you can't do it with a Lorentzian integral, right? Because you can calculate Lorentzian integrals, but they're propagators, right? And they aren't clearly related to wave functions. But more importantly, I want to talk about I think Neil is comfortable with the conformal factor now, but I just for the rest of you that might not be comfortable, conformal factor. In the resulting wave function, I didn't write down and have to write down any sort of rotation of the conformal factor, because we know what the wave function is. It's just those transverse traceless. But suppose we wanted to write an integral that looked a little more covariant, right? Then, following Fadayev and Pavlov, we can add back the degrees of freedom that were eliminated by gauge and constraints by well-known identities like this, integral of dx, e to the ix squared is 1, integral of x over delta of x is 1, and you can reconstruct the whole Fadayev-Pavlov structure with gauge-fixing conditions, delta functions, determinants, and so forth. But, so you can keep adding the variables back in, but you can never reach the covariant Einstein action, because as well known, it's unbounded below because of the conformal factor problem. But completely equivalently, you can reach one with the conformal factor rotated. And this was discussed to all orders in perturbation theory by a Canadian scientist, Kristen Schlein. And so the conformal rotation is not, I believe, a problem in anybody's integral. Okay, that was the second 5 minutes. Here are my main points again. No boundary wave functions are alive, well, and predictive at the level of semi-classical gravity, at least. That's all we have enough to complete. That's enough to compare predictions with observations, for the most part, because that's all we have control over. There's several possible different approaches to going beyond, one of which is yours, right? The semi-classical approximation, integrals, dualities, and perhaps others that I don't even know about. We should compete these, I believe, in trying to explain the biggest of experiments, which is quantum cosmology from the Big Bang. Thank you very much.
So one thing, Jim, in terms of your discussion and Claudia's at the beginning, I want to make a statement, see if you agree. The path integral as formulated by Feynman and in ordinary quantum mechanics is really only meant to give you a propagation from one initial condition to another. It is never proposed to give you a wave function.
I don't know what Feynman had in mind.
I mean, it's a propagator, as Claudio discussed, from initial to final state, and then you have to integrate over initial states with some wave function. But the wave function itself is not a path integral. In the ordinary, let's even take it out of quantum cosmology.
When you finish, tell me, right, and I'll start.
Just talk about quantum mechanics. Right. I'm finished.
Okay. So let me make a remark about this. Let me make a historical remark. I think all this stuff about integrals was my fault. Right? Stephen may have had the idea. He certainly attracted Euclidean. But I was motivated mostly by comparisons with observations. If you look at the early universe, it's more homogeneous, more isotropic, more helium thermic equilibrium with small fluctuations. So I thought, that looks like the ground state. Right? But in a theory that's reparametrization invariant, there is no ground state that is has the lowest eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian is zero. Right? But in there is another construction. I don't, so from what you say, it's not due to Feynman, which is you can in field theory. And I gave an example actually in the case of the linearized perturbations. You can construct the ground state as a Euclidean functional integral, not the higher states, but just the ground state. So I disagree with your comment. You can construct, it's a matter of the boundary conditions. The difference between propagators is sometime in the past, there's another state. The other integrals are Euclidean and typically vanish in the far past as this one does. So I thought, why not apply this to gravity? And we're off and running with integrals.
So can I just reply that if you take the ground state wave function of harmonic oscillator, it's a simple Gaussian, it's not an integral.
It can be expressed as an integral, however, over histories in the past. Of course, the result, right, doesn't.
Just a Gaussian, not an integral over anything.
That's what makes it a nice example to show people.
So would you then say that you don't, the main thing is the wave function and whether you can or cannot represent it as a path integral is a secondary importance? Is that in some sense your main
the question?
Is the wave function the main thing and whether or not it's a path integral is just a secondary consideration?
Well, that's sort of what I was trying to do. That as far as the observations, at the semi-classical level, I don't think we need the integral. But, you know, it's a question of how far do you want to search for principles? The integrals is one way, but it's not the only way of doing it. Maybe there are further ways. So I think integrals are well worth investigating.
I think if we want to have lunch by 1 o'clock, we should cut off the questions now.
Thank you very much.